Welcome to Inspiration and Transformation from the Banks of the Ganga with Sadhvi Bhagwati Saraswati, an American sannyasi living at the Parmarth Nikatan Ashram in Rishikesh, India. Sadhvi is president of the Divine Shakti Foundation, a charitable organization bringing education, vocational training, upliftment, and empowerment programs to women and children. Sadhvi is also Secretary General of the Global Interfaith WASH Alliance and Director of the world-famous International Yoga Festival. Join the musings of an American sannyasi as Sadhvi shares the wisdom and teachings of her guru, His Holiness Pujya Swami Chidanand Saraswatiji.
Welcome, everyone, to Inspiration and Transformation from the Holy Banks of the sacred Ganga River in the land of Rishikesh, India. When I go to temple, go to holy places, I think in my mind about what I have to talk to God about. Questions I have. I really want to talk to God and share my questions. But when I get there, I forget. I forget what I have to say. Cannot remember anything. And then when I get home, I feel so foolish and I repent that how is it I've got this whole list of things to talk to God about? But then when I get there, I can't remember them. And the question was, why does this happen? And can you help me so this doesn't happen? And actually, it's so beautiful that it does happen. This is exactly what should happen. Pujya Swamiji always says, ki tragically hum log list leke isht ke pas jate hain. That we go to God with a list of things that we want. And so we go to God with, oh God, give me that, give me this, do that. I want this, I want that. But obviously that's not the point of going to God. We go to God to connect with God. That is the gift. That is the point. Connection to God is not an ends to a means. No, sorry, a means to an end. Connection with God is the end. And so we don't need lists. When we are connected to God, everything happens. When we are connected to God, that which I think I need to know, it dissipates. Not because suddenly I know the answer to this, or I know the answer to that, but because suddenly my separation from the question, suddenly my residence in my thinking mind that needs to know this answer, that answer, suddenly that has disappeared. And instead of residing in a thinking mind that makes lists, I'm residing in the heart. I'm residing in spirit, I'm residing in consciousness, I'm residing in that connection where there are no questions. I remember when I first came to India, Pujya Swamiji used to have open darshan at a very specific time every day. And it lasted exactly an hour. And typically the hour was taken up by all of the people who were there. And it was fine. I didn't actually have anything to say. I just wanted to be in his presence. But after a few days, suddenly, there were still minutes left to the hour and everybody else was done. And so he asks me if I have any questions, and I'm obviously very flustered, and I wasn't expecting to be asked if I had any questions, and I couldn't think of anything at the moment. I was in such a state of joy and bliss, just being in his presence. But I'm a straight-A academic, and when you get asked, you know, when you get put on the spot, you better come up with something, and you better come up with something intelligent. You better come up with something that shows that you're a, you know, worthwhile human being. You don't want to ask something that's stupid, something that's too trite. There's a lot of pressure. And so I decided that I was going to prevent that from ever happening again, because in that moment I couldn't think of anything. I was going to prevent that from happening by thinking at other times about good, sensible, intelligent questions that I would ask him should that moment ever arise. And I came up with 3 or 4 of them. And one thing you have to know about me is I've got a photographic memory. It's just something I was born with. It's dissipating tragically with age, but nonetheless, at that time when I was 25, it was still very, very good. And I'm someone who, that's how I got through school, was just the ability to memorize things. I was not someone who forgot. And a few days later, there I am again. Situation arises. He says, yes. And I cannot for the life of me think of any one of those questions, not even one. And again, of course, I feel utterly embarrassed, and I'm thinking, he must think I'm such a fool. Like, I cannot say anything intelligent. How could someone not have any questions at all? I'm 25, I'm American, I've just come into this world. How could I not have a question? So I then decided, okay, I'm going to make a list. I'm going to write them down. If I can't remember them, if my brain has become a sieve, okay, I'll just write them down, I'll make a list. And so I did, and I used to have one of those very light, small, I'm sure you've seen them in the market, kind of hand-woven purses that has a thin thread across the shoulder, and it's just a kind of small thing. I only needed to carry my room keys and some chapstick and, you know, maybe 50 rupees or something if I wanted water or a cup of tea. I didn't have anything else to carry. And I put my list in there. So again, comes up a few days later, and I'm thinking, oh, great, I've got my list. I'm so prepared today. And I open my bag, and the list is gone. Now, many of you, if you are not women, have seen the inside of what most women's purses look like, whether your mothers, whether your wives, and the whole mess of all kinds of junk in it. My purse is no different. However, at that time, as I said, there was no junk. I wasn't carrying anything around other than my room keys, chapstick, and a little bit of money. I didn't even have a wallet. I just had, you know, like 10 rupee notes. And there's no pockets in the bag. It's not even a very big bag. There's no zippers. There's nothing. It's just a cloth. And I literally, in front of Swamiji, take the bag and I turn it upside down. Out come my 10 rupee notes. Out come my room keys. Out comes my chapstick. And there's nothing else. And I'm looking in, and he's looking at me and smiling, and it's gone. And I say, it must have somehow fallen out along the way. I'll be right back. Can I come right back? And he, as just this ocean of compassion, smiles and says, sure. So I run out, convinced that it must have somehow fallen out of my bag between my room and the office. And I retrace my steps. It's nowhere. I go back into my room. I then proceed to thrash my room. I'm pulling sheets off my beds. I'm taking the pillow out of my pillowcase, as though somehow my list would have fallen into my pillowcase. I mean, just beyond any sense of reason, because it had to be there. I mean, obviously, I looked on the table first. It wasn't there. My room was small. It was just one table, 2 beds. Couple shelves, nothing else. Not on the table, not on my shelves, nothing. So I'm literally undoing my beds At which point I finally stopped and I realized there is clearly no way this list has fallen into your pillowcase. It's gone. And as embarrassed as I was, I of course had to walk back because I knew he's waiting for me. And so I come back and I hang my head and I'm thoroughly embarrassed. And I say, I guess I have no questions. And it was just the most beautiful moment because it made me realize clearly the universe was trying to teach me something. Clearly you don't just suddenly become tongue-tied, blank-minded, then forget every item on your list, then lose your list, if it was about the questions. And in that moment, it was this beautiful awareness of, oh, I guess I have no questions. And so that's the teaching, is when you're in the presence of the divine, don't worry. Don't worry about what questions you think you have. Just allow yourself to be in that divine presence. And don't feel like a fool at all. The foolishness is to try to get something much, much less than the possibility. The foolishness is to beg for, you know, a hair from someone who's a king. When you're in the presence of one who is everything, to ask for just a little bit of intellectual, cognitive, thinking mind food for that mind to play with, a little bit of cognitive, intellectual understanding about something, when you could actually be in the presence of the infinite, it's selling yourself short. And so becoming questionless in that moment is actually exactly what's supposed to happen. So it's very, very beautiful. That's what God wants.
You're listening to OTR-FM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Being a radio host on IOM-FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single...
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Elia, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
Hi, this is Christina Ricci with RAIN. Every 2 minutes, another American is sexually assaulted. If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, you are not alone. Help is just a call or click away through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Please call 1-800-656-HOPE, that's H-O-P-E, or visit rain.org, that's RAINN.ORG.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
Welcome back to Inspiration and Transformation. I'm so glad to have you all back here with me. We're not the body, we're not the mind, we're the soul. How do we know that? How do we realize that? Is it through a process of meditation? Is it through a process of watching your breath? Is it through a process of listening to a sound? There's a lot of different ways in. The first and most important aspect is to really believe that. To at least first understand intellectually, and then we'll go into the experience. But you need to at least know that where you're going is real. There has to be a sincerity in that quest. Any kind of mantra or affirmation, it works only if you know that it's true, but you just can't convince yourself. And so reciting, I'm the soul, I'm not the body, I'm the soul, I'm not the body, is going to work only if you actually do know that's true, you just forget it. You do know and you do agree and recognize it's the highest truth, but you just have difficulty in living it. It's not going to work so well if you really believe, as tragically so many people do, that they are their bodies, that they are their titles, that it really is all about me. It is all about how I look. It's about how much money I make. It's about where I live. It's about who's the one on my arm. It's about how people treat me. So in order to have that experience, I have to first at least know in my heart, even if I can't live it every moment, even if I slip and I forget, at least I need to know in my heart, oh yeah, I'm not the body, I'm the soul. Otherwise, the affirmations are just words. So the first part is to cultivate an awareness. And this may come from reading, from the sages, from the saints, from the enlightened ones. You read enough enlightened people saying the same things, becomes hard to convince yourself they're wrong. Another way is there's actually a lot of even scientific evidence if you think about things like reincarnation, which is just one manifestation of the fact that we're not the body. If I were the body, if I were the mind, then when I died, I, not just the body, would be over. So me having a memory of a different body would be a phenomenon that never existed. That can only exist if there is something other than the body that is constant and consistent. And we actually have lots of scientific evidence, lots of stories of people, typically children, young children, before that curtain drops, who tend to come into this world vividly remembering their past lives. Swamiji's shared with me the story of when he met these two little boys for the first time who remembered exactly their past lives and where they'd lived and the cabinet in their home and what was in that cabinet. And they actually went there. It was in a little village and they actually went there. And opened the cat, you know, knocked on the door, and the people didn't know who they were, and they were like, well, you know, this kid and this cabinet in the room, and they opened, and of course, it was exactly what he said, and he said, my things. So that's just one story I know personally because Pooja Swamiji has shared it with me, but there's so much evidence. There's evidence in your own life. If you think for a moment about all of the years that you've been saying I. So a child of this age, he says I. He says me. He knows me, mine, right? Give me the iPad, my iPad. I'm taking pictures. That's my, right? He knows. He's probably been saying I for at least a few years. Well, we were all saying it at that age. And then we were saying it at 10, at 15, at 20, at 25, at 30, at 35. Depending however old we are, we've been saying I since we were this tall. Our body has changed an infinite number of times. Our mind has changed an infinite number of times. what we know, what we can do, what we think. All of that, our emotions. And yet there is a consistency. If we are the body and we are the mind, then who's this I? What is it? What's the thread that weaves through us? And so you can get at it like that. And suddenly an awareness of, oh yeah, wait. I can even think back. I mean, I can picture myself as a very young child. There's a few moments in which I can even get into that body, into that experience, and sort of see the world through her eyes and think, I. Who is that I? And how am I in this body able to access that? What's the common thread? So, soul, spirit, self, whatever term you use. But the first step is at least to convince ourselves intellectually, in our minds, in our hearts, both, that we know that's true, we just have difficulty living by it. And then we embark on a practice to make that more and more a part of our actual experiential life. And a very powerful way to do that is a very powerful meditation that we do that's called Neti Neti. And the Neti Neti meditation is one that begins by saying, I'm not my clothes. Okay, everybody agrees with that. I'm not my skin. I'm not my bones. And you go in, you go layer by layer by layer. I'm not this, I'm not that. And we all know that. Nobody's gonna shout, yeah, 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 I am my skin. You know, you get sunburned, your skin peels off, you're still there. Well, okay, I'm not my organs, I know that. Lose an organ, get a transplant, I'm still here. I'm not my blood. Donate blood, somebody gets my blood, they don't become me, I get a blood transfusion, I'm not somebody else, I'm no less of me because I've donated blood. You go through layer by layer all of the self, including our thoughts. Well, I'm not my thoughts because my thoughts come and go. If I were my thought, I would cease to exist after each thought. But we know I don't cease to exist because if I ceased to exist in the space between my thoughts, who would be the I who was thinking the next thought? There would be a thought. Then if I ceased to exist, there'd be no more thoughts ever again. Unless I is something that gets created, which we know it isn't. So I'm not my thoughts. I'm not my emotions because they change. I'm angry one minute, happy another minute, scared another minute. So what is it that I am? And you just go through thing by thing that I'm not. And of course, you know that if you can use the possessive, if you can say mine, my thoughts, my body, my emotions, well, if it's mine, it's not me. My paper, not me. My microphone, not me. My hair, not me. My fingernails, not me. Well, if something is mine, it's not me. So all of the things I can say, my this, my that, my feelings, my history, my identity, my personality. It's not me. And so you peel these layers back one by one, and if you do it sincerely enough and focused enough, you'll get to a point as you do it, maybe not the first time, but as you keep doing it, where as the layers peel back, you'll reach a space where you just are. There's nothing left to peel back. And in that space, there's an experience of spaciousness, of oneness, of light. And it's experienced by different people in so many different ways, but that's the experience that we get. And yeah, sometimes in that moment, sound comes. You can hear the sound of Om, for example, the sound of the universe. And so sometimes listening to that or chanting that puts us at the same frequency as the universe is vibrating. And so it's helpful in that way. The breath is helpful, of course. I find, honestly, as many of these things as you can do simultaneously, the better. Because the mind is very, very active. At least mine is. And so the more I can give it to do, the more likely it's not thinking. The more likely it's not judging. The more likely it's not planning. So if I'm aware of my breath, if I'm chanting a mantra or chanting Om, and I'm simultaneously either peeling back layers of what I'm not or simply meditating on the truth, because I do deeply, deeply believe it and have experienced it at times. It comes, it goes, it comes, it goes, but I've had enough experiences for long enough to know that it's true. That I am the soul. And so whether I'm just meditating on I'm the soul, whatever it may be, but you can do all of those things simultaneously. Someone whose mind isn't quite as active may not necessarily need three things to do simultaneously. But I find that it works, at least two. And the breath can be done with everything. And then just go through this process. And it'll take you deeper and deeper and deeper into it.
This is OTRFM, part of the iOM radio network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth Radio is conscious living for your soul, every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Mike Baldwin with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip with the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with inspiration and transformation. Well, first of all, it's important to realize that the desire itself is not the problem. The problem is the attachment to getting the desire fulfilled. So I may desire chocolate ice cream cone. Stick with my earlier example. I get it, great. I don't get it, no problem. The, oh my God, I can't believe I didn't have a chocolate ice cream. I really needed a chocolate ice cream. Oh my God, I'm not going to be able to sleep tonight. I'm so depressed. I really need chocolate ice cream, right? You see how that becomes a problem. But of course, it's silly in that sense. But we do it in so many other ways. I have a desire to get a job I applied for. I have a desire to be loved and accepted. I have a desire to be approved. I have a desire for all these things. I have a desire for the stock market to go up. I have a desire to get to work without any traffic. Nothing wrong with these desires. The problem comes when they don't manifest. You're stuck in a traffic jam and it becomes, oh my God, God, I hate this. Right? Now, whether it's 20 minutes or 2 hours, your car is already stuck. Nothing you can do about that. But now, internally, you've become stuck. Now, instead of using those 2 hours to do your japa, to do your chanting, with your eyes open, of course, but you can listen to kirtan, you can listen to spiritual inspiring talks, you can think, you can contemplate, you can watch your breath. And there's an infinite number of things you can do stuck in a car. If you're not the one driving, there's even more things you can do. But even if you're the one driving, nonetheless, so much you can do to make those 2 hours actually beneficial, not just tolerable. But if, because I was so attached to getting there without traffic, the traffic has upset me so much, I'm now angry. All I do with those 2 hours is curse the traffic, curse people who have made me late, get on the phone with everybody. My God, can you believe it? I'm stuck in traffic again. I can't believe we have to live in these suburbs. But, you know, it's because I don't make enough money or my husband doesn't make enough money. We got to send our kids to school. The school is cheaper out here. It's all his fault. It's my boss's fault. So that's the other way it goes. Useless and damaging. So the desire itself is not the problem. The problem is the attachment to it being fulfilled, and then how we react and lose ourselves when it's not fulfilled. So that's the first part. Second is, yes, we have desires for enlightenment. Wonderful. Desires for spiritual awakening, progress, understanding. Obviously, these things are much deeper and more meaningful than a chocolate ice cream cone. As long as we have desires, we should make sure to desire things like that. But the rule is the same, which is when you find that you're still not enlightened after days or hours or months or years of meditation, we shouldn't be any more depressed than we are when we don't get our chocolate ice cream cone or when we're stuck in traffic. So the rule is still the same. No problem with the desire. And in this case, it's a great desire because desires actually are what end up catalyzing us. I have a desire not to lose my job. Therefore, I drag myself out of bed every day and show up at work. I have a desire not to feel hungry, therefore I eat food. I have a desire not to smell bad, therefore I take a shower. Desire is a catalyst. I have a desire to feel good, therefore I go and get a massage, or I sit in the sunshine, or whatever it may be. Desires are actually what propel all of our actions. I have a desire to quench my thirst, I drink water. Desires are the energy that moves us. The difference is whether it's superficial and material or deep and spiritual. But nonetheless, if there were no desire, there'd be no movement. You could say, I have a desire to be just a vehicle in the hands of God, totally surrendered to God. Still a desire. I have a desire to be just used by the divine. Still a desire. That's what's going to catalyze me. So these desires are beautiful. You just still have to be careful of the attachment to it being fulfilled according to my timeline. Because the greatest danger on a spiritual path is the inner voice that says, oh, forget it, this isn't going to work. Still not enlightened. Look at that, you lost your temper again today. You're useless. Really? You've been meditating a year and you still allowed lust, greed, anger to run away with you? How could you talk to that person like that? How could you be like that? How could you do this? Forget it. Clearly, meditation's not doing anything for you. Just give it up. So that's the insidiousness of the ego. So you have to be really careful about that. So yes, we have the desire for spiritual progress, for enlightenment, for freedom. That's why we walk a spiritual path. I have a desire to eventually reach Calcutta, let's say. Well, that's why I'm going to get in a train headed to Calcutta. But if I'm not there in 5 minutes, I don't want to start having a panic attack. Probably takes a few days to reach there by train. If I'm going by foot, it's going to take me a lot longer. So moving in that direction, but without an attachment to the expectation of how quickly it's going to happen.
This is OTRFM, part of the iOM radio network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth radio is conscious living for your soul every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Baldwin with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip with the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with inspiration and transformation. How can we find the right balance between the silence and solitude that is so often conducive for spiritual progress and interacting in the physical world to do more tangible seva? Seva is service, selfless service. In the West, we say, you know, you could say volunteer work, but that really doesn't even begin to touch what seva is. Seva is service of humanity, of God through humanity, of God through nature, of the Creator through the creation. So it's selfless in that way. But unlike something just like volunteer work, seva is really also a deep spiritual practice. It's not so much we are serving others because we are so fortunate and we are so skilled and we are so wonderful and they are unskilled or poor or disadvantaged, and so from over here we serve them. It's not that. Seva, really, as a spiritual practice, is serving others as a means also for our own spiritual awakening. At which point, of course, it doesn't matter whether you're cleaning toilets or stuffing envelopes or designing websites or doing any one of thousands and thousands different types of things that people would do in seva. Because it's not about the toilets you're cleaning or the carrots you're cutting or the chapatis you're rolling or the website you're designing or the envelopes you're stuffing. It's about using yourself as a as a tool really in the hands of the divine flow, and using your time and your energy in service as a way to break these borders and break lines between self and other, break value judgments, and just give of the self. So with that definition, how do we balance the quiet and the silence and the solitude that's needed for spiritual practice and being in the world in service? Well, the balance looks a little bit different, of course, for each person. We all have different temperaments and we all have different sadhana practices. But in general, here, for example, where the ashram is rooted in the teaching, really, Pooja Swamiji's philosophy is that the most natural byproduct of the right meditation, the most natural byproduct of deep sadhana, deep spiritual practice, is service. Because in your meditation, you experience a sense of oneness with the world. In your meditation, you experience a sense of being in the hands of the divine. In your meditation, you experience a desire more and more and more to just be hollowed out and be empty, so that more and more of the divine will can flow through you. And so the most natural byproduct of that is to come out of the meditation and say, what can I do? So for us here on a specific level, the balance tends to look like we all have our own practice in the mornings, in the nights, during the day perhaps. Those are what we would call charging your batteries. And then the rest of the day is spent in seva. But here's the important aspect is it's really important to not have there be, again, these boxes. Seva is a spiritual practice. So it's not about my spiritual work, sitting on a cushion, sitting in the dark room, sitting with my eyes closed, sitting on a mat, and I charge my battery, and then I go out and I expend my battery, and when it's all empty, I've got to go back and, you know, sit in the dark room and cross my legs and sit on my mat. It's through my meditation, I have the renewed, energized awareness experience of the preciousness of being alive, the incredibleness of every moment and every minute of being alive, and therefore an eagerness in every minute and every moment to be actively connected to the world, life, the creation. And so whether that comes in the form of cleaning the toilets or cutting the carrots or stuffing the envelopes or designing the website or doing whatever it may be, there's an eagerness to see how much I can give to every minute and every moment. There's an eagerness to see what new thing can come through me today. Yeah, I've stuffed envelopes every day for the last 4 months. I'm going to be stuffing envelopes again today. But nonetheless, what newness in me, in my experience? And I've specifically chosen tasks that seem very, very mundane. Because obviously if something is exciting and glamorous and romantic and objectively important, it carries within it its own excitement. But the real beauty and challenge and excitement of the seva and sadhana is how can even the most mundane things like cleaning toilets and cutting vegetables. Be exciting opportunities for me to give even more of myself, to be even more present, to be even more committed, even more sincere, even more at one with the toilet I'm cleaning, the carrot I'm cutting, the knife I'm using to cut it, the person who has used the toilet that I'm cleaning, the person who will eat the carrots that I'm cutting, the person who grew the carrots, the farmer, the earth in which they grew. I mean, there's a whole variety of ways that one could connect with that. It's not just about how many carrots do you chop. And so when we talk about the importance of the solitude and the quiet, yeah, it's important. It's important to reconnect us to who we are and what it's about. But ultimately, the goal is that that should come with you into the seva. It's not about, I have my silence, I have my solitude, I leave that in my closed room, then I go out and do something that is not meditative or quiet. It's just that instead of the quiet being outside of me, the quiet now becomes inside of me. Instead of the solitude being around me, the solitude now is within me. And that's the gift, is how can I find a quiet that stays with me? And that's what meditation gives us. But then it stays with us in the world. That sense of connection that we experience in meditation stays with us in the world. And so the emphasis becomes on meditation in life. Yoga in life. When we say yoga off the mat or meditation off the cushion, it doesn't just mean, you know, what's your volunteer program of the month? It's not just, you know, yeah, the third Saturday of every month we come together and we make sandwiches for the poor people. That's great. We should all do it, by all means. But that's not the fullness of the expression. When we really talk about yoga off the mat, or meditation off the cushion, or yoga in life, meditation in life, it's about every minute of life. It's about how can that which I connect with in my meditation, how can I experience that in the world? So for example, when I meditate and I connect with my inner self, soul, spirit, essence, light, love, and I realize as I meditate that all of that around me is just form. It's not essence. Well, when I then open my eyes and I move through the world and someone looks the wrong way, too fat, too thin, too dark, too white, too tall, too short, too rich, too poor, too loud, too quiet, I have the same awareness, ah, that's just form, not essence. Because when I've connected with that in me, I understand that about others. And so that, in a nice, beautiful way, actually circles us back to the first question on judgment, because if I take myself out of the box, then I'm taking others out of the box. And then I find that instead of moving through the world, connecting form to form, I'm able to connect essence to essence. And as I experience that in myself, the things that happen to the form are no longer of the stuff that ups and downs are made of. Doesn't mean that we don't get sad or that we don't feel happy. I mean, certainly things happen in life. Spirituality, I always say, is not an inoculation against things happening in life. But they don't impact us in the way that they do when we are identified as form. And so whether it's something in my job, whether it's something in a relationship, whether it's something about my physical appearance, as I'm connected with essence and aware that who I am is essence rather than form, I'm not as thrown around by the fluctuations in form. And I'm not as impacted by the fluctuations in form of others. Oh my God, he got a horrible haircut. Oh my God, she gained some weight. Oh my God, it's the form has shifted ever so slightly. But the essence is the same. And so that enables us, yes, to do our seva and also to live our lives, whatever we're doing, in a way that's completely different, in a way that is quiet, is alone even, the question asked about solitude, because inside, you're alone. And in a very beautifully paradoxic way, you're alone and connected at the same time. But it's not a connectedness that makes you feel claustrophobic. It's not the everybody's encroaching on my space, but it's an experience of it's all my space. There is no end to my space, where previously it was just this is my space, and when there's too many people and too much stuff, it's encroaching. Suddenly you've got this beautiful experience of A, being connected to it all, but not being encroached upon by any of it, because it's all my space. There's an infinite amount of space. And so if we can bring that quiet, that inner quiet, because the truth is, the stuff that bothers us, that really steals our peace, is almost never the noise outside. Not never. There have certainly been places and times where there is a noise outside that is absolutely grating. But that's very rare. Normally, the noise that really steals our peace is the noise in our own mind. And so you can go to the quietest place in the world, but you've still got your own mind. And if you're able to allow the mind to become quiet, then even if you go into a place that's loud outside, you're sitting in a place that's quiet. And so that stays with you. This brings to a close this hour of inspiration and transformation. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so glad to be together with you all each week, and I look forward to being together again next Thursday, same time, on Om Times Radio.